From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in June when protesters raised banners and their voices in the state capitol in Albany, holding a sign that read, "Stop the suffering, pass the bill." Advocates for what's often referred to as medical aid in dying were pushing for the issue to become legal in New York State. Some of the protesters held canes, telling the New York Times that they were slowed by the effects of cancer treatment. They were taking part in the demonstration to try to change the outcome for what has been the case of a proposed bill in the state legislature for about a decade. Proposed, yes. Passed, no. And once again this summer, the bill failed to advance through the legislature. That was the fifth straight time. Medical aid in dying, which allows people who are terminally ill to access medication that helps end their lives, is legal in 10 U.S. states and in Washington, D.C. 19 states, including New York, continue to consider it. There are pieces of legislation that have generated fierce debate, and supporters say it would help people avoid suffering and be able to have peaceful deaths with dignity. Opponents counter that patients may feel pressured to end their lives, especially if they are given inaccurate diagnoses or don't have all the information that could help them make informed decisions. The debate has raised questions about the roles of patients, physicians, and who should be able to access life-ending drugs, if anyone. It has also raised concerns among people in the disability community who say that right-to-die laws could lead to broader applications that could have unintended consequences. And in Canada, which we will talk about, since 2016, there has been a MAID law, M-A-I-D, Medical Aid in Dying, and there has been some backlash on exactly these grounds about who is counseled in this direction, who ends up using this opportunity. This hour, we explore the issue from a number of perspectives, and we can take questions from and comments from you, and I'd like to welcome our guests now. The lead pastor at Ridgeland Community Church is Fritz Longabaugh. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Chris Hildebrand is on the line with us, executive director of the Rochester Spinal Association. Chris, welcome back. Thanks for making time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And I want to let listeners know that about 6 weeks ago or so, we were in touch with a filmmaker whose work was visiting Rochester. It's a documentary called Last Flight Home. And the director and producer of the film was set to join us today. And we're still trying to make that contact. The director and producer of the film chronicled her father's medically assisted death in California and his desire to use that option and the story that played out in that family. So let me start with you, Chris. I've talked to you about many issues over the years. I don't think this is one that you and I have talked about, and I don't know where you are on this. One thing that stood out to me when I was reading before this program was that the disability community generally, and again, I'm not speaking for every person with a disability, but generally speaking, there are a lot of groups that have opposed this kind of legislation. Where are you on this, Chris?
Sure. It is definitely a nuanced and complicated and sensitive issue. I think personally and, as well as some other disability groups, nobody's advocating that people should have to live in awful pain for, what remains of their life. But it's also, how do we handle it? How do we have a way of going about, a dignified, comfortable death? And I think a lot of the concern is right now our society often overlooks having a dignified life. So I think disability groups really want to make sure we are, advocating and providing really, adequate supports during life before we start, pushing a death choice upon people.
I'm looking at some of the reporting from Jacobin Online, which, is certainly a pretty strong left-leaning publication. And Jacobin's reporting on the Canada laws has been pretty brutal. This is some of what Jacobin reports. Canada now has one of the highest assisted death rates in the world. Jacobin and The Guardian reported that in February, 4.1% of deaths in that country were physician-assisted. And the number is growing. In a survey of just over 13,100 people who opted to use medical aid in dying in Canada, a significant majority, 96.5%, chose to end their lives in the face of terminal illness or imminent death. But that's 463 people in Canada who chose it. And again, I don't want to speak for them, but in some ways were counseled to have the choice. when they were not facing imminent death. They have a chronic condition. That's 463 mm-hmm. people. Disability and other advocates have been warning for years that this kind of law can put people at risk. They warn that the risk of people choosing death because it is easier than fighting systems that impoverish people, don't provide good health care, don't provide good assistance to people with disabilities is real. And what Jacobin concludes, essentially, is that when you look at individual stories like that in Canada, there are too many for them to conclude that the law is being applied as it was sold a decade ago. That too often it's someone who is poor or someone with a disability who ends up choosing medical aid and dying long before they would have naturally died. And Jacobin's conclusion is the law is a disaster and it gives cover to a system that doesn't work for people in poverty and people with disabilities. And that's a pretty brutal take from an organization and a publication that seemed to support medical aid and dying about a decade ago. How do you see that, Chris?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that reporting, so it's definitely striking that that is really exactly the concerns that disability groups have voiced for a long time. You know, I remember some of the earlier laws passed in other states in the U.S. Were very, you know, ineloquent at the best in how they defined terminal condition, that sometimes it was something simply that, you know, was going to reduce your lifespan and was resulting in living in pain. And there are a lot of us, like, realistically, I have lived a fair long time. Like, I, you know, broke my neck when I was 14. I've lived 35 years with that. You know, at some point, it is likely that it will, you know, limit my lifespan. Does that mean that I have a terminal condition? And some of the bills in the U.S. were very poorly written in that way. And it sounds like in Canada, it's been implemented very much in that way.
I want to ask the pastor, first of all, where you stand on this. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about where advocates are. But Fritz, where are you on medical aid and dying?
Well, I was a head chaplain of New York State's largest hospice for some time, and I've had the blessing of seeing a lot of people die and walking with them when they're dying. So I think a middle way where we don't prolong life artificially beyond its natural point is important, but I also think we shouldn't short-circuit life. And the legislation before New York State, I think, comes more out of fear than faith, more out of despair than hope. And I've seen so many beautiful things happen in people's dying days that I just would, it breaks my heart to even think about ending those. And I think that's what's happening in Canada.
So let me explore a couple points that you make there. When you say on the one end of it, you don't think we should be extending life artificially or beyond sort of a natural conclusion, what does that look like?
So I think when the body can no longer perform its basic functions of breathing or circulating blood or, as is most often the case, eating, artificial feeding tubes or artificial nutrition, hydration, then that's the time that it's time to let go of life.
Okay. And how do you draw lines where some families or individuals might say, you know, I would like the opportunity to live as long as I can, even with that kind of assistance.
I should correct what I just said. If I think you can opt.
You can choose that.
You can choose
Shouldn't
that.
Be forced that.
But there are plenty of people, and Chris probably knows people like Joni Erickson Tata, quadriplegic, who chose not to do that and has lived a fantastically fruitful life. So I would say that it is a valid moral choice at that point, but it's not a necessary choice.
And not a mandatory one.
Okay. Exactly.
Okay. You also, I don't want to speak out of school. I think you mentioned before the program, you keyed in on a word which is used often, and we've had conversations over the years on this program as this legislation has been considered. The word is dignity. So you often hear death with dignity.
Right.
And I don't think you prefer that term, but why? Tell me how that hits you.
Well, I think the proponents of this legislation that's coming before New York State, they are motivated by compassion. They've seen people that they love die, and it's really difficult. Facing mortality is not easy. It's hard. The term they use is they want death with dignity, and I think that that's probably not the best way to do it, because what we do in life is we value ourselves based upon self-created meaning. Do I make enough money? Am I good looking enough? Am I achieving enough? And when we face our mortality, those things are stripped away, and you see it again and again on hospice and in church life, that people question their value. when those things are stripped away. But that's the very moment where we need to say to them, you have intrinsic value as a human being, as someone created in the image of God. They're vulnerable at that time. This legislation would say to them, if you think your life isn't worth living, go ahead, you can take the pill. But I think that's the very time when we need to fight for their lives. And that's a statement about hope, not despair.
Okay. And then the other thing that comes to mind for me is the kind of story that we see in Last Flight Home, or that we see in still a vast majority of cases in Canada, which again has had this law now for the better part of a decade, in which most people are older, their prognosis is they will not live much longer. They have a terminal condition. And sometimes that does involve really tough physical circumstances, a lot of pain or suffering. And so, Pastor, why shouldn't they be able to say, look, this is the moment for me to choose this, that I know that my life on this earth is ending, and 3 more weeks would be really, really difficult and devastating for me and for those who love me. And if we can all gather around and we can do this quietly and with dignity, again, that's the word they would use, that's the choice that I want to make. Why not make that an option?
Because I think it's coming out of fear, twofold fear. One fear is that there's not medicine, there's not medication that can ameliorate the physical pain that I'm experiencing. That's not true. We have incredible palliative care knowledge. And so death can be portrayed as horrifying, but it isn't. That's one thing that people who work in hospice really understand, is that it need not be so very physically difficult. So, for example, when I was working in the hospice, our medical director had overseen, over 1,000 patients. And she said, of that 1,000, only 4 ever had what she called uncontrollable pain. And significantly, those 4 were all related to emotional pain. Emotional pain looks a lot like physical pain, but it has a different cause. So there's a fear that it's going to be so uncomfortable that I can't handle it. And that's almost always not true. But there's also a fear, and this is where the dignity part comes in, that if I have all the things that I value about my life, meaning my independence or my achievement, if that's stripped away from me, then I'm worth nothing. And that's simply not true. Now, you have to let me speak as a Christian here. Again, created in the image of God. But when Jesus went to the cross, he pronounced the most profound statement on human value that there is. Even people who were uncomprehending about what he was doing and vicious toward him, he loved. That's the profound value statement on human life. And what I've seen over and over again, from deathbed to deathbed, is people encountering that value in a new way. It is tough, because in that stripping away process, we're mortal, we have to deal with that, we deal with that throughout our life. But there is a value placed on life, and God cares for the people, whether they're believers or unbelievers. Psalm 116 says, precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of all his faithful ones. And I've seen that again and again. Whether you're a believer or not, God is there for you. That's the hope.
Chris, how do you see the word dignity in this debate and discussion?
I think there's a lot of us, disability, not disabled, whatever. Like, when we look forward to the future and we imagine ourselves approaching our final end, that I think a lot of people would like to have some control over that. So I think that's maybe where, dignity or choice or not suffering makes some gut sense to a lot of people. I think then, though, it's much more complicated, because we're not a perfect society, and how we talk to people about what their choices are varies based on a lot of things. What is the diagnosis? What is your, financial status? What race are you? So I think that's where, unfortunately, we can't, we're not at a place really to be able to provide, choice over death in a really equitable manner, that, sometimes slippery slope gets put around. And that's a little maybe what we're seeing in Canada, that, there's a piece of things that people are advocating for, and for good reason. But unfortunately, then it gets applied in other circumstances to very negative effects for people who might otherwise, with better information, better options, better support, definitely make the choice to live with dignity.
In a moment where I want to listen to some of the comments that the great Diane Rehm, who listeners know from her many years as a great talk show host, she has become an advocate for medical aid in dying because of what happened with her husband. And we're going to listen to some of what Diane had to say. But I have a chance now to bring in Andy Timoner, who is with us on the line from California. And I'm glad that we can make this this connection. So, Andy, thank you for making this work, and welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's good to be here. I was just listening for a little while there.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us a little bit about, I know that you didn't expect to end up making a film for the public to see necessarily when everything was happening with your father, but you did. You tell that story in Last Flight Home. And can you describe for listeners maybe some of the outlines of what happened with your father and why you wanted to make that film?
Sure. So I've been a documentary filmmaker for, over 30 years. And my father has always been a hero to all of us in the family for how he handled becoming paralyzed from an accidental stroke that happened when I was 9. He was 53 years old. And so he lived for 40 years as a hemiplegic, lost his airline that he had founded, was sidelined due to all the stigma to do with disability, and yet remained super positive and rooted for us always, and just was the rock and the heart of the family, and was always so tenacious and never, ever, ever talked about dying or wanting to die or leave us or anything like that. And he just, became sick with COPD, and what we came to find was congestive heart failure. And it just was getting harder and harder to breathe. And he ended up entering the hospital at 92 years old in January of 2021. And having been in there for 5 days, they sort of sorted out the COPD for now, at least, but the 5 days in bed meant he couldn't walk again, and he was going to have to go to a facility. And he was, terminally ill. And he said, please, he called repeatedly and suddenly said to me and my two siblings, please, please help me go. Please help me die. And I can't do this anymore. And he said, I've served my sentence. I've done my time, and we couldn't really argue with that, yet we didn't know that there was a law in California that would allow him the right to medical aid in dying until my brother thought he had heard something roughly about it. So he went and found that, in fact, with a 15-day waiting period, there was, and a lot of guardrails, there was a law that allowed terminally ill people with 6 months or less to live to do this, as long as they could do it by themselves. And so he immediately wanted to do that. And I sort of panicked and realized, I was losing my favorite person in the world. I had no idea how to cope with it. And I realized I had cameras. And I thought it might be very inappropriate to film my father in his last days. So I went to see a therapist, and she, to my surprise, said, if you think you should film, you should film. And I asked my dad, and he said, I instinctively know you're on the right track. So I set up cameras when he came home to start hospice and to begin that 15-day waiting period. And the footage, I didn't expect to document such an incredibly beautiful and transformative time in all of our lives, but it was exactly that. And it was really something that it felt incumbent upon me to share, not just because we ended up becoming total activists for medical aid in dying being something that everyone should have a right to. It's a very compassionate law. And it made my dad so hopeful, so peaceful, and it allowed every member of our family to come around him and experience a kind of closure that never would have been possible if he hadn't had the ability to choose a date. None of the grandkids would have made it home from college. My sister, who's a rabbi of the largest synagogue in Brooklyn, would never have been able to plan to be out there and to help him through this passage. So all of it, everything you see in Last Flight Home is because of medical aid in dying in a way. I mean, it gave my dad a sense of agency and peace he never had. And, you know, in 40 years, he didn't have any power over his own body. And this finally gave him a chance to say, here's the date. I'm going to go. And I want my family surrounding me. And I want to take care of this. And I'm going to go on to my next adventure now. And it was very profound and very beautiful. And we've all been able to kind of move on knowing that he got to accomplish this in his last days. So, yeah.
Ani, as I'm sure you now know, 10 states plus DC have medical aid and dying laws. And, you know, we had done quite a bit of conversation on this program 10 years ago when it seemed at the time that it was almost imminent that, you know, New York, but a lot of states would go in this direction. Here's the list. Oregon, rather famously, 1994, and then it wasn't until 2009 that the second state, which was Montana. So Oregon in 1994, Montana 2009, Washington 2009, Vermont 2013, California 2015, Colorado 2016, DC 2017, Hawaii, Maine 2019, New Jersey 2019, and New Mexico 2021. So in the last decade, you had all these states getting on board, and it seemed like the kind of thing where the culture was moving and legislatures were moving. It wasn't just ostensibly blue states, but it hasn't quite happened that way. And I think part of it is you used the word guardrails, Andy. You said that there was a 15-day waiting period, that there were very important guardrails there. And I think some of what has happened is that states, whether it's legislatures or individuals, have looked at what has happened, and they want to know, are there guardrails, and will those guardrails stay there? Can you describe for me what you meant by that, and if you're comfortable that this movement that has been happening, that slowed a little bit now, if there are proper guardrails in place?
So first of all, that was a really helpful list, but you should add to it that the United Kingdom just passed medical aid in dying last week. Mm-hmm. So that's a great victory for all the terminally ill people and their families who will be able to utilize that right now in the United Kingdom. So that's really helpful. I think the Catholic Church has been the main reason that things have slowed here. It's been a real campaign to try to stop people from accessing this right. The guardrails are, you know, a 6-month diagnosis, terminally ill. The person who is asking for the right to medical aid in dying has to meet with a doctor and explain why they want to do this. You know, and it can't be, oh, my family's pressuring me to do this. It's, I want to go and here's why. And then, you know, another doctor, a different doctor, and at least in the case of my father, met with my father, who was not a proponent of medical aid in dying, and still, you know, obviously because it's a law and a right in California, he heard my father out. He assessed whether or not he was mentally capable of making this decision, whether or not he was still capable. That was like 7 days in. Now, by the way, in California, it's a 48-hour waiting period. So it's not the same as what my father did.
Yeah.
He had to sign multiple documents and really confirm that he understood the directions, and he had to do it himself. And now family members can help, which I think is much more compassionate. Now, there were three drinks that my dad had, There were three phases to what he had to do, as you'll see in the film. Now there's one drink, which is also a much more compassionate move on behalf of California citizens, because the first two like slowed his heart and his breathing. And so then it became very, very difficult for him to hold the glass for the final drink by himself. It was almost like, here's a terminally ill person, and now they're really, really compromised, and now they have to try to do this drink in 2 minutes, or they could go into a coma. So it just was like not ideal the way that the hoops he had to jump through at the end there, after having proven to everyone that he was very much of right mind and, you know, and a sound mind and capable of doing this himself, and wanted to. So those are some of the guardrails. They're different per state. Every state has its own, you know.
Yeah. But, and the reason I wanted to ask about this, Andy, is because I want to read a little bit of how the Canada law is now perceived as having changed quite a bit since 2016. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is David Brooks's piece for The Atlantic. David Brooks wrote about the Canadian MAID, M-A-I-D, Medical Aid in Dying Law, last year. I'll quote the piece now at length. Quote, "As originally conceived, the MAID program was reasonably well-defined. Doctors and nurses would give lethal injections or fatal medications only to patients who met certain criteria, including all of the following. The patient had a serious illness or disability. The patient was in an advanced state of decline that could not be reversed. The patient was experiencing unbearable physical or mental suffering. The patient was at the point where natural death had become reasonably foreseeable." To critics who worried that before long, people who were depressed, stressed, or just poor and overwhelmed would be provided assistance to die, authorities were reassuring. The new law would not endanger those who are psychologically vulnerable but not near death. Citing studies from jurisdictions elsewhere in the world with similar laws, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau declared that this simply isn't something that ends up happening. But the program has worked out rather differently. Before long, the range of who qualifies for assisted suicide was expanded. In 2021, the criterion that natural death must be reasonably foreseeable was lifted entirely. A steady stream of stories began to appear in the media, describing how the state was granting access to medical aid in dying to people who arguably didn't fit the original criteria. And one example was the Associated Press's report of the case of Alan Nichols. Nichols had lost his hearing in childhood. He had suffered a stroke, but for the most part was able to live independently. In June 2019, at the age of 61, he was hospitalized out of concern that he might be suicidal. He urged his brother Gary to bust him out of the facility as soon as possible. But within a month, he applied for a physician-assisted death, citing hearing loss as his only medical condition. A nurse practitioner also described his vision loss, frailty, history of seizures, and general failure to thrive. The hospital told the AP that his request for a lethal injection was thus valid, and his life was ended. And his brother then told the Associated Press, quote, "Alan was basically put to death," end quote. I bring this up, Andy, because the Canadian law has changed a lot, and the guardrails that people wanted are not necessarily the same. And I wonder if that worries you, and if that's maybe a cautionary tale, or if you think, you know, that that is overstating it. How do you see that, Andy?
I think that people should have a right over their own bodies. I think it's interesting, you know, the lethal injection is a very different way of administering medical aid in dying than certainly what happens in California. So, you know, it might have been different if that was the option that he had to take the medicine himself. If he was taking the medicine himself, then there would be no way to say he was put to death, you know? That said, I've heard many people on the other side say that lethal injection is a much more compassionate way to go. So I don't really know, like, you know, it's not, I'm a filmmaker, and shared Last Flight Home was because, not only because of medical aid in dying and feeling like, wow, I had no idea what this was. Our family had no idea it existed. And we, you know, everything you see in the film is because of this. But at the same time, what we did as a family, in the way that we said goodbye to our father, in the way that it's really helped so many families, whether who aren't doing medical aid in dying, just with healing or just with planning, you know, certain things that my sister brought as a spiritual leader into the household, but also things that we kind of innovated and came up with at the time. And then of course, my dad is very, very funny and very, very smart. And so he was just constantly, you know, sharing wisdom with us that now is shared with everyone else. So there's a lot to the power of film that is the reason for Last Flight Home. It's not just sort of a polemic of for medical aid in dying. So I don't know that I'm the person to answer that question, but I do think that it's a right everyone should have. Because when you become terminally ill, you're no longer in a position to fight for this right. You know, if you are in a state and you don't have the financial capacity to die, for example, if you're in a state that has medical aid in dying and you're a veteran, I don't know if you know this, but there's a gag order. So you're not allowed to be informed of that right, because there's a federal ban on support for medical aid in dying. That is, even in the 10 states where it's legal, it is Medicaid and Medicare can't cover it. And so you have to have a certain amount of money to afford to die in this country, even if you're in a state with that right. And if you're in a state without the right and you're too far away from Oregon or Vermont to get over there, then you can't have that and you must go through suffering. And I mean, I could tell you one more thing about that came to mind about the Jewish approach to the law. It used to be against Jewish law. When the movie came out, my sister had to write an article to kind of get ahead of it because she was concerned because it was against Jewish law to help anyone die.
Again, your sister's a rabbi. A rabbi, yeah.
Yes, yeah. You know, she's Senator Schumer's rabbi. She's a very influential rabbi. I've just made a new movie that actually I've been making for 2.5 years before Last Flight Home and 2.5 years since, called All God's Children, that you can look up. And it's actually the pastor who was speaking should look it up too. It's about a partnership between her temple and a Black Baptist church to stop racism and anti-Semitism in Brooklyn. And it's being extremely well received.
Andy,
right,
can
now.
I chime in about the guardrails you were talking about?
Well, I want to say one thing about Jewish law, and that is that the rabbis changed the law since Last Flight Home and have said in the years since that a law without tenderness is wickedness, and that when the rabbis wrote this into Jewish law, that at that time, the average time of suffering was maybe days to a week. And now, because of our healthcare, it's years that a person can be suffering. And what is life without there being any ability to have any joy and to have any peace while alive? How is that helpful to anyone? So that's the new take. And I think that really I urge the pastor and his followers and, you know, everyone to kind of open their minds to, it is 2024 and it might be time to think about changing your stance because of the circumstances of how it is to live today in this world with a terminal illness.
Yeah. Let me let our other guests get in. We've got in a moment, we'll turn to Chris Hildebrandt, who's the executive director of the Rochester Spinal Association, Pastor Fritz Longabaugh in studio from Ridgeland Community Church. Go ahead, Pastor.
So, Andy, I congratulate you because your father was a stroke victim and he managed to find joy for 40 years. So I would never say that people who are terminal cannot find joy. But let me say a word about guardrails. Canada passed medical assistance in dying in 2016. And at that time, the requirement is they had to have a terminal diagnosis. They removed that 4 years later. And one of the qualifying conditions for medical assistance in dying is anorexia. Anorexia. In Belgium, which also has assisted death, that includes autism. The story of a woman named Zoraya Terbeek is someone at age 21. She was diagnosed with autism, and she was very depressed. She began wearing a sign around her neck that said, "Do not resuscitate." And she advocated for the right to die from autism. Now, I find that very dark. That's one of the slippery slopes that Canada is on, and I'm concerned about that. But I think what I want to do is put this rush toward medical-assisted death in a broader cultural context. I have to ask, why is it that there's this rush for this legislation now when pain control has become so advanced? What's going on now that we are looking to death as a solution? Okay. From 2000 to 2020, the suicide rate in the general population, not the terminally ill population, in the general population increased 30%. What's that about? Okay, there's another phrase that some of us know, deaths of despair, which includes suicide or drug overdoses or alcohol-related deaths. According to the New England Journal of Medicine, middle-aged white people in the last 10 years have increased deaths of despair 41%. Black Americans, that number has tripled over the last 10 years. What is going on? The dying process has been made so much easier, and yet so many more people are choosing it. There's one more number I want to give, and this is from a researcher from University of Virginia named Christopher Room. He asked the question, how do we measure despair? And he looked at the mental health community. There's something called the Behavior Risk Factor Survey. It's a large federally administered data collection site. And he looked at all the numbers of days that people reported having a, quote, poor mental health day. And there's some clear criteria for that. He noted that from 1993 to 2019, that number increased 53%. So we are having this cultural moment where despair is creeping in. And I think that that's a lot of the motivation that goes along with this proposed legislation in New York State.
Well, Chris Hildebrandt, what do you hear in some of this debate and what stands out to you?
I think, you know, in Andy's story, and I definitely appreciate the challenge the family went through and respect the father's decision, but some of what we heard in that story also was, you know, it's very disappointing for me to hear that his father felt he had no control over his body. Like, I'm a quadriplegic. My body doesn't work from like my mid chest down. You know, but I still feel I have control over my body. I have functioned and done a lot in life. You know, also it sounded like, you know, societal discrimination happened. His father had lost his business throughout life, and like, that's terrible. And that's our society, you know, putting these, you know, stressors and barriers on people that, are discriminated against. So I think there are those things. And I think, as the pastor was just saying, sometimes we're, fixing the wrong problem. In Rochester 20-ish years ago, maybe 25 years now, there was a guy who was a quadriplegic, had lived his entire life post-injury at Strong Hospital. He was injured in the late 60s when there really weren't community options available. He got to be the late 90s, and his mother had passed, and he really started talking about wanting to end it for himself. And he was assisted, essentially. Pre-laws for this, he was allowed, the hospital gave him, allowed him to request a higher dose of morphine to repress his breathing, and then he was able to spit out and refuse his respirator. So he was allowed or assisted to die instead of being provided community supports, instead of being provided mental health therapy for, oh, your mom died and you've been living in the hospital for 30 years. That's really hard. You know, so we kind of go about solving the wrong problem sometimes. Mm-hmm.
I am really, really late for the only break that we have to take. We got to do that now. The film we're talking about is called Last Flight Home. And the filmmaker, Andy Timoner, is here talking about not only the film, but her father's medically assisted death in California. Chris Hildebrandt, executive director of the Rochester Spinal Association. Fritz Longaball, lead pastor at Ridgeland Community Church. All having this conversation. We're right back after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson, host of Connections. We bring you in-depth conversations with newsmakers, with people from all backgrounds and points of view in our community. And it's a chance for you in the audience to join the conversation in various ways. 2 hours every weekday. We're proud to bring you these conversations, and we look forward to joining you next time on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to listen to that clip from Diane Rehm when she was on this program a couple of years ago. Former, of course, national radio talk show host that you've probably listened to many times. And she has become an advocate in this space after the death of her husband. And let's listen to some of what Diane Rehm told us. In this film, you ask such an important question. You ask, what about a doctor's Hippocratic oath to do no harm? When it comes to physician-assisted dying, how does that interplay with this idea that a physician's oath is to do no harm? What have you found to be the answer to that important question?
Well, the answer varies depending on which doctor you're talking to. For those who are in favor of medical aid in dying, it is that the patient should be the one who determines whether harm is being done. by offering, for example, one more treatment, one more X-ray, one more radiation treatment, that simply may prolong by weeks or days a person's life. On the other hand, you have doctors who say, I am going to keep a patient alive as long as possible. That is their understanding of do no harm. But who should be the decider of harm? Who should determine how much pain I am willing to experience? Should it be the doctor or should it be the patient? Who should it be who defines harm?
Well, certainly I think many people might decide that it should be their own choice. It should be their own definition. And everyone will have different parameters, yeah.
And absolutely, you know, if a person says, my faith is going to determine when God decides to take me, and I support that view completely if that is that person's decision. Mm-hmm. If another person says, I want everything that you as a doctor and medical science can provide to keep me alive, I support that position. And I want you not to accept, but simply to understand that my position for myself should be to have the right to make my own decision for me. So let's look at this across the board as a situation where choice should be what's at play.
That's Diane Rehm on this program a couple of years ago. I want to ask all of our guests what they hear there. Andy Timoner, what do you hear there from Diane?
I hear the basic right, the human right to have power over our own bodies as much as we can, or just, it's hard to say power over our own bodies, but to have the agency and to have the ability to make decisions for our own bodies. I've been constantly mystified by people thinking that the government or a religious institution should have any right over another person's body. You know, it's one thing, the abortion debate, when there, you know, is a question of is their life involved. This is a person and their own body at the end of their lives and their suffering. And I think that it's not for any of us to stand outside of another person and say, this is what you have the right to do or don't have the right to do. And to correct the gentleman who spoke about my father and how wonderful it was that he had the ability to have joy for 40 years after a stroke. Of course, he never asked to die during that entire time. He was sidelined, and he was generally, probably most people would have been very unhappy by a lot of the losses that he suffered because of discrimination against disabled people. But he managed to remain positive when he decided that he needed to go. It was a desperate time for him. And it was only because we discovered medical aid in dying that he was able to be the upbeat, wonderful presence and have his, you know, his everything return, his energy and his humor and everything returned, because he had the hope that he could leave this life and be out of pain. And I think whoever is claiming that there's enough pain medication to make life bearable now, I've been documenting a man dying of pancreatic cancer for the last year. And the pain that I have witnessed in that process, there is no amount of opioids and no amount of painkillers for some of these diseases, and it makes life unbearable. And why should we cause people to stay alive, spend a bunch of money, suffer needlessly? For what? What is the purpose? I do ask that question of everyone else on this panel.
We're going to get some listener feedback in just a second. I want to just turn to Chris Hildebrandt and say that I think, Chris, certainly weigh in here from your perspective, but I think part of what I'm hearing in this ongoing debate about states that are looking at medical aid and dying is whether this kind of law, if it passes, would be applied to people like Diane Rehm's husband and essentially people in that circumstance, or if it eventually ends up being used for people who are struggling with depression, or if people who have a disability and the system really isn't working for them and end up, you know, sort of with that option on the table. Because I think I from what I'm reading in a lot of different places like Canada, that's the debate. It's like, is this the Diane Rehm's husband situation? Is this something broader and much farther than that? And where does individual liberty go? And when is the system actively working against people? So, Chris, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. And I think that's fairly accurate. I think that disabled or otherwise, there are a lot of people who in a more perfect world would like to have choice and control over when and how we go. I think that is true. I think the challenging reality is we are in a very imperfect world. There's a lot of data about, you know, the misperceptions from doctors and medical professionals about what it is to live with a disability, what it is in terms of quality of life, in terms of, you know, day-to-day pain or day-to-day suffering. And like, I frequently am meeting people with a brand new injury, and they can't wrap their head around more than like what's right in front of them right now. They can't picture how good their life will be 2 years from now or whatever, that they're in this moment. And it's unfortunate that right now a lot of decisions, important decisions, might be made in that moment, whether it's disabled or a new diagnosis or an initial experience with some pretty traumatic pain, that we can't see what's down the road. And unfortunately, people could be, you know, pressured to make a decision right then.
Okay.
This is for terminally ill people with 6 months to live, not people who have just
those
had
diagnoses,
to be clear.
But those diagnoses are often wrong as well. And the concern is that it may be for other things that, you know, as we were talking about in Canada, it starts with one thing and then you can kind of interpret the law differently or just change the law.
Well, so
it's about guardrails.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah, certainly that idea about what the guardrails are and why it matters and why that differs place to place. Ruth in Rochester also wants to weigh in on some of what the pastor said about pain management. Go ahead, Ruth.
Hi. Yes. So pain management really hasn't come that far. I live in a lot of pain and I'm not close to wanting to die from it, but to take that choice away from me when it starts to get worse is I think that's criminal. I think I should be allowed to make these decisions. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Thank you.
Pastor, you want to respond to that?
Sure. Well, for one thing, end-of-life care is not mandatory training in most medical schools. So a lot of doctors don't know about how to manage pain. That's something that is a concern. Your caller really needs to be heard. But I want to quote someone, a young woman named Rosina Camus. She's from Canada, and she eventually took her life under the MAID Act. But she said something really interesting about pain. She said, I think, this is in an email, I think if more people cared about me, I might be able to handle the suffering caused by my illnesses. And she went on to say that sometimes all the pain goes away just by having another human being there. Now, I want to be careful because that's one specific example, and I don't want to paint everything with a broad brush. However, what that does is it points out, again, that physical pain and emotional pain are sometimes hard to distinguish.
All right. So as we get ready to wrap here, I want to remind listeners, this debate, you heard Andy say that Great Britain, they're going down this road. Just last week, they passed medical aid in dying. Canada's had it since 2016. A number of other countries do. 10 American states have passed medical aid in dying laws. Washington, D.C. has it. New York State's law, some form of the legislation's existed for about 10 years, and it has not progressed out of the legislature. So that's the status. You've heard a lot of the debate this hour. Andy, if people want to see Last Flight Home, what's the best way to get in touch or do that?
So it's on Paramount Plus. It's also on Amazon and most other kinds of platforms. But it's on Paramount Plus right there on the home screen.
And I want to
Compassion and Choices. I should mention Compassion and Choices. If you are listening to this and you want to know more about your rights, go to Compassion and Choices. We partnered with them and they're really, really advocating for people to have this basic right.
It takes about 30 seconds of seeing the film to realize the love that Andy's father had for the family and the family for him. And regardless of anyone's views on that, I do wish you and the family peace. And thank you, Andy, for taking time to come on the program and tell that story today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Andy Timoner is director and producer of the film Last Flight Home. It chronicles her father's medically assisted death in California. You'll find Fritz Longabaugh as the lead pastor at Ridgeland Community Church. And Pastor, thank you for making time to be on the program and discuss this today.
A pleasure.
And I want to thank Chris Hildebrand, executive director of the Rochester Spinal Association. Chris, always good to talk to you. Thank you for making time. You're generous with it.
You're very welcome, and thank you.
Listeners, again, we've had a number of conversations on this topic. This will not be the only one, but I think you're pretty well up to speed on where things are with these pieces of legislation here and around the country, and I thank you for all of the feedback. Couldn't get through all of it today, but a lot of feedback here. From all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on member-supported public media.